This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels by John Meacham. Read for you by Fred Sanders. With an introduction and conclusion read by the author.
To Evan Thomas and Michael Beschloss. History, as nearly no one seems to know, is not merely something to be read, and it does not refer merely or even principally to the past. On the contrary, the great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways, and history is literally present in all that we do. James Baldwin. The presidency is not merely an administrative office. That's the least of it. It is more than an engineering job, efficient or inefficient. It is preeminently a place of moral leadership. Franklin D. Roosevelt. Nothing makes a man come to grips more directly with his conscience than the presidency. The burden of his responsibility literally opens up his soul. No longer can he accept matters as given. No longer can he write off hopes and needs as impossible. Lyndon B. Johnson. Introduction. To hope rather than to fear. Back of the writhing, yelling, cruel-eyed demons who break, destroy, maim, and lynch and burn at the stake is a knot, large or small, of normal human beings. And these human beings at heart are desperately afraid of something. Of what? Of many things, but usually of losing their jobs, being declassed, degraded, or actually disgraced. Of losing their hopes, their savings, their plans for their children. Of the actual pangs of hunger, of dirt, of crime. W.E.B. Du Bois, Black Reconstruction in America. 1935. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union, when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Abraham Lincoln, First Inaugural Address, 1861. The fate of America, or at least of white America, which was the only America that seemed to count, was at stake. On the autumn evening of Thursday, October 7, 1948, South Carolina Governor Strom Thurmond, the segregationist Dixiecrat candidate for President of the United States, addressed a crowd of 1,000 inside the University of Virginia's Cabell Hall in Charlottesville. The subject at hand, President Harry S. Truman's civil rights program, one that included anti-lynching legislation and protections against racial discrimination in hiring. Thurmond was having none of it. Such measures, he thundered, would undermine the American way of life and outrage the Bill of Rights. Interrupted by applause and standing ovations, Thurmond, who had bolted the Democratic National Convention in July to form the States' Rights Democratic Party, was in his element in the old Confederacy. "I want to tell you, ladies and gentlemen," Thurmond had said in accepting the breakaway party's nomination in Birmingham, Alabama, "that there's not enough troops in the Army to force the Southern people to break down segregation and admit the Negro race into our theaters, into our swimming pools, into our homes, into our churches." The message was clear. He and his fellow Dixiecrats, he told the University of Virginia crowd, offered the only genuine obstacle to the rise of socialism or communism in America. Civil rights, Thurmond declared, were a red plot against the free world. Only the States' Rights Democrats and we alone have the moral courage to stand up to the communists and tell them this foreign doctrine will not work in free America. Nearly 70 years on, in the heat of a Virginia August in 2017, heirs to the Dixiecrats' platform of white supremacy, 21st century Klansmen and neo-Nazis among them, gathered in Charlottesville, not far from where Thurmond had taken his stand. The story is depressingly well known. A young counter-protester, Heather Heyer, was killed. Two Virginia state troopers died in a helicopter crash as part of an operation to maintain order. And the President of the United States, himself an heir to the white populist tradition of Thurmond and of Alabama's George Wallace, said that there had been an egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides, as if there were more than one side to a conflict between neo-Nazis who idolized Adolf Hitler and Americans who stood against Ku Klux Klansmen and white nationalists. The remarks were of a piece with the incumbent president's divisive language on immigration, among many other subjects, from political foes to women, and his nationalist rhetoric. Extremism, racism, nativism, and isolationism, driven by fear of the unknown, tend to spike in periods of economic and social stress, a period like our own. Americans today have little trust in government. Household incomes lag behind our usual middle-class expectations. The fires of fear in America have long found oxygen when broad, seemingly threatening change is afoot. Now, in the second decade of the new century, in the presidency of Donald Trump, the alienated are being mobilized afresh by changing demography, by broadening conceptions of identity, and by an economy that prizes information age brains over manufacturing brawn. We are determined to take our country back. David Duke, a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, said in Charlottesville, "We are going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. That's what we believed in. That's why we voted for Donald Trump. Because he said he's going to take our country back. And that's what we gotta do." For many, the fact that we have arrived at a place in the life of the nation where a Grand Wizard of the KKK can claim all too plausibly that he is at one with the will of the President of the United States seems an unprecedented moment. History, however, shows us that we are frequently vulnerable to fear, bitterness, and strife. The good news is that we have come through such darkness before. This book is a portrait of ours in which the politics of fear were prevalent, a reminder that periods of public dispiritedness are not new, and a reassurance that they are survivable. In the best of moments, witness, protest, and resistance can intersect with the leadership of an American president to lift us to higher ground. In darker times, if a particular president fails to advance the national story, or worse, moves us backward, then those who witness, protest, and resist must stand fast in hope, working toward a better day. Progress in American life, as we will see, has been slow, painful, bloody, and tragic. Across too many generations, women, African Americans, immigrants, and others have been denied the full promise of Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. Yet the journey has gone on and proceeds even now. There's a natural tendency in American political life to think that things were always better in the past. The passions of previous years fade to be inevitably replaced by the passions of the present. Nostalgia is a powerful force, and in the maelstrom of the moment, many of us seek comfort in imagining that once there was a Camelot, without quite remembering that the Arthurian legend itself was about a court riven by ambition and infidelity. One point of this book is to remind us that imperfection is the rule, not the exception. With countries as with individuals, a sense of proportion is essential. All has seemed lost before, only to give way, after decades of gloom, to light. And that is in large measure because, in the battle between the impulses of good and of evil in the American soul, what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature have prevailed just often enough to keep the national enterprise alive. To speak of a soul at all, either of a person or of a country, can seem speculative and gauzy. Yet belief in the existence of a collection of convictions, dispositions, and sensitivities that shape character and inform conduct is ancient and perennial. There is a rich history of discussion of what the Swedish economist Gunnar Myrdal, writing in 1944, called the American Creed, devotion to principles of liberty, of self-government, and of equal opportunity for all, regardless of race, gender, religion, or nation of origin. Echoing Myrdal, the historian Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. wrote, "The genius of America lies in its capacity to form a single nation from peoples of remarkably diverse racial, religious, and ethnic origins. The American Creed envisages a nation composed of individuals making their own choices and accountable to themselves, not a nation based on inviolable ethnic communities. It is what all Americans should learn, because it is what binds all Americans together." I have chosen to consider the American soul more than the American creed, because there is a significant difference between professing adherence to a set of beliefs and acting upon them. The war between the ideal and the real, between what's right and what's convenient, between the larger good and personal interest, is the contest that unfolds in the soul of every American. The creed of which Myrdal and Schlesinger and others have spoken can find concrete expression only once individuals in the arena choose to side with the angels. That is a decision that must come from the soul, and sometimes the soul's darker forces win out over its nobler ones. The message of Martin Luther King, Jr., that we should be judged on the content of our character, not on the color of our skin, dwells in the American soul. So does the menace of the Ku Klux Klan. History hangs precariously in the balance between such extremes. Our fate is contingent upon which element, that of hope or that of fear, emerges triumphant. Philosophically speaking, the soul is the vital center, the core, the heart, the essence of life. Heroes and martyrs have such a vital center. So do killers and haters. Socrates believed the soul was nothing less than the animating force of reality. "What is it that present in a body makes it living?" he asked in the Phaedo. The answer was brief and epical. A soul. In the second chapter of the book of Genesis in the Hebrew Bible, the soul was life itself. "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." In the Greek New Testament, when Jesus says, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends," the word for life could also be translated as soul. In terms of Western thought, then, the soul is generally accepted as a central and self-evident truth. It is what makes us us, whether we are speaking of a person or of a people, which St. Augustine of Hippo, writing in The City of God, defined as an assemblage of reasonable beings bound together by a common agreement as to the objects of their love. Common agreement as to the objects of their love. It's a marvelous test of a nation. What have Americans loved in common down the centuries? The answer sheds light on that most essential of questions. What is the American soul? The dominant feature of that soul, the air we breathe, or to shift the metaphor, the controlling vision, is a belief in the proposition, as Jefferson put it in the Declaration, that all men are created equal. It is therefore incumbent on us, from generation to generation, to create a sphere in which we can live, live freely, and pursue happiness to the best of our abilities. We cannot guarantee equal outcomes, but we must do all we can to ensure equal opportunity. Hence a love of fair play, of generosity of spirit, of reaping the rewards of hard work, and of faith in the future. For all our failings, and they are legion, there is an abiding idea of an America in which anyone coming from anywhere, of any color or creed, has free access to what Lincoln called the just and generous and prosperous system which opens the way for all. Too often, people view their own opportunity as dependent on domination over others, which helps explain why such people see the expansion of opportunity for all as a loss of opportunity for themselves. In such moments, the forces of reaction thrive. In our finest hours, though, the soul of the country manifests itself in an inclination to open our arms rather than to clench our fists, to look out rather than to turn inward, to accept rather than to reject. In so doing, America has grown ever stronger, confident that the choice of light over dark is the means by which we pursue progress. For reasons ranging from geography to market capitalism to Jeffersonian ideas of liberty, Americans have tended to believe, without irony, that Thomas Paine was right when he declared that we have it in our power to begin the world over again. In the twilight of his life, Franklin D. Roosevelt recalled the words of his old Groton School rector, Endicott Peabody, who had told him, "Things in life will not always run smoothly. Sometimes we will be rising toward the heights. Then all will seem to reverse itself and start downward. The great fact to remember is that the trend of civilization itself is forever upward, that a line drawn through the middle of the peaks and the valleys of the centuries always has an upward trend." Roosevelt quoted that observation in his final inaugural address in the winter of 1945, and American power and prosperity soon reached epic heights. The Peabody-Roosevelt gospel seemed to get it right. The world was not perfect, nor was it perfectible, but on we went in the face of inequities and inequalities, seeking to expand freedom at home, to defend liberty abroad, to conquer disease and go to the stars. For notably among nations, the United States has long been shaped by the promise, if not always by the reality, of forward motion, of rising greatness, and of the expansion of knowledge, of wealth, and of happiness. So it has been from the beginning. Even before the beginning, really, if we think of 1776 as the birth of the nation. "I always consider the settlement of America with reverence and wonder," John Adams wrote in 1765, "as the opening of a grand scene and design in Providence for the illumination of the ignorant and the emancipation of the slavish part of mankind all over the earth." Jefferson, too, spoke of the animating American conviction that tomorrow can be better than today. In his 82nd year, Jefferson wrote of a march of civilization that had, in his long lifetime, passed over us like a cloud of light, increasing our knowledge and improving our condition, and where this progress will stop, no one can say. In the middle of the 19th century, the minister and abolitionist Theodore Parker defined the American idea as the love of freedom versus the law of slavery. Frederick Douglass, the former slave who became a leading voice for equality, believed deeply in America's capacity for justice. "I know of no soil better adapted to the growth of reform than American soil," Douglass said after the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision in 1857. "I know of no country where the conditions for effecting great changes in the settled order of things, for the development of right ideas of liberty and humanity, are more favorable than here in these United States." Eleanor Roosevelt, niece of T.R., wife of FDR, and global human rights pioneer, wrote, "It is essential that we remind ourselves frequently of our past history, that we recall the shining promise that it offered to all men everywhere who would be free, the promise that it is still our destiny to fulfill." Self-congratulatory? Even self-delusional? At times and in part, yes. It's an inescapable fact of experience, though, that from John Winthrop to Jefferson to Lincoln, America has been defined by a sense of its own exceptionalism, an understanding of destiny that has also been tempered by an appreciation of the tragic nature of life. "Man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible," the theologian and thinker Reinhold Niebuhr wrote in 1944, "but man's inclination to injustice makes democracy necessary." We try, we fail, but we must try again and again and again, for only in trial is progress possible. Deep in our national soul, we believe ourselves to be entitled by the free gifts of nature and of nature's God, and in the theological frame of our Creator, to pursue happiness. That ambient reality has been so strong that even the most clear-eyed among us have admitted the distinctive nature of the nation. Intellectually, I know America is no better than any other country. Emotionally, I know she is better than every other country, the novelist Sinclair Lewis remarked in 1930. He was not alone then, nor would he be alone now. To know what has come before is to be armed against despair. If the men and women of the past, with all their flaws and limitations and ambitions and appetites, could press on through ignorance and superstition, racism and sexism, selfishness and greed, to create a freer, stronger nation, then perhaps we, too, can right wrongs and take another step toward that most enchanting and elusive of destinations, a more perfect union. To do so requires innumerable acts of citizenship and of private grace. It will require, as it has in the past, the witness and the bravery of reformers who hold no office and who have no traditional power, but who yearn for a better, fairer way of life. And it will also require, I believe, a President of the United States with a temperamental disposition to speak to the country's hopes rather than to its fears. In the 1790s, with the Alien and Sedition Acts, the Federalists sought not just to win elections, but to eliminate their opponents altogether. In the age of Jackson, South Carolina extremists threatened the Union, only to be put down by a president who, for his manifold flaws, believed in the Union above all. Anti-Roman Catholic sentiment, driven by immigration, gave rise to a major political movement, the Know-Nothings, in the years before the Civil War. The Reconstruction era featured several instances of progress and light in the passage of crucial constitutional amendments concerning equality and in U.S. Grant's 1870-71 stand against the Ku Klux Klan, only to give way to Jim Crow laws and nearly 100 years of legalized segregation. In just the past century, during World War I and after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, a new Ku Klux Klan, boosted in part by the movie The Birth of a Nation, took advantage of American anxiety to target blacks, immigrants, Roman Catholics, and Jews. The fear that the huddled masses of Emma Lazarus's poem The New Colossus would destroy the America that whites had come to know helped lead to the founding of the 20th century Klan, a nationwide organization that staged massive marches down Pennsylvania Avenue in 1925 and 1926. Isolationists and Nazi sympathizers took their stand in the 1930s. Their influence evaporated only with the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor on Sunday, December 7, 1941, and Adolf Hitler's subsequent declaration of war on the United States. Then there was the anti-communist hysteria of the early Cold War period and the white Southern defense of segregation in the civil rights era. Our greatest leaders have pointed toward the future, not at this group or that sect. Looking back on the Dixiecrat challenge, Harry Truman, the man who won the four-way 1948 presidential campaign, triumphing over the segregationist Thurman, the progressive candidate Henry A. Wallace, and the Republican Thomas E. Dewey, once said, "You can't divide the country up into sections and have one rule for one section and one rule for another, and you can't encourage people's prejudices. You have to appeal to people's best instincts, not their worst ones. You may win an election or so by doing the other, but it does a lot of harm to the country." Truman understood something his legendary immediate predecessor had also grasped. That, as Franklin D. Roosevelt observed during the 1932 campaign, the presidency is not merely an administrative office. That's the least of it. It is more than an engineering job, efficient or inefficient. It is preeminently a place of moral leadership. All our great presidents were leaders of thought at times when certain historic ideas in the life of the nation had to be clarified. As Truman and Roosevelt and Jackson and Lincoln and Grant and T.R. and Wilson and Eisenhower and Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson and Ronald Reagan, among others, understood, the President of the United States has not only administrative and legal, but moral and cultural power. "For only the President represents the national interest," John F. Kennedy said, "and upon him alone converge all the needs and aspirations of all parts of the country, all departments of the government, all nations of the world." There was nothing, Lyndon Johnson remarked, that makes a man come to grips more directly with his conscience than the presidency. Sitting in that chair involves making decisions that draw out a man's fundamental commitments. The burden of his responsibility literally opens up his soul. No longer can he accept matters as given. No longer can he write off hopes and needs as impossible. The office was a crucible of character. In that house of decision, the White House, a man becomes his commitments, Johnson said. He understands who he really is. He learns what he genuinely wants to be. I am writing now not because past American presidents have always risen to the occasion, but because the incumbent American president so rarely does. A president sets a tone for the nation and helps tailor habits of heart and of mind. Presidential action and presidential grace are often crucial in ameliorating moments of virulence and violence, and presidential indifference and presidential obtuseness can exacerbate such hours. We are more likely to choose the right path when we are encouraged to do so from the very top. The country has come to look to the White House for a steadying hand in word and deed in uneasy times. As Woodrow Wilson observed more than a century ago, the president is at the front of our government, where our own thoughts and the attention of men everywhere is centered upon him. About that, there has long been little debate. His person, countenance, character, and actions are made the daily contemplation and conversation of the whole people, John Adams wrote in 1790. After his own presidency, Adams observed, "The people ought to consider the president's office as the indispensable guardian of their rights," adding, "The people cannot be too careful in the choice of their presidents." In 1839, his son John Quincy Adams wrote that the powers of the executive department, explicitly and emphatically concentrated in one person, are vastly more extensive and complicated than those of the legislature. The British writer and statesman James Bryce, in his American Commonwealth, published in 1888, described the presidency as "this great office, the greatest in the world, unless we accept the papacy, to which anyone can rise by his own merits." The political scientist Henry Jones Ford, writing in 1898, observed, "The truth is that in the presidential office, as it has been constituted since Jackson's time, American democracy has revived the oldest political institution of the race, the elective kingship." The emphasis on the presidency in the following pages is not to suggest that the occupants of the office are omnipotent. Much of the vibrancy of the American story lies in the courage of the powerless to make the powerful take notice. "One thing I believe profoundly, we make our own history," Eleanor Roosevelt, who knew much about the possibilities and perils of politics, wrote shortly before her death in 1962. "The course of history is directed by the choices we make, and our choices grow out of the ideas, the beliefs, the values, the dreams of the people. It is not so much the powerful leaders that determine our destiny as the much more powerful influence of the combined voice of the people themselves. We are a better nation because of reformers, known and unknown, celebrated and obscure, who have risked and given their lives in the conviction that, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." This is not sentimental. "Surely, in the light of history," Mrs. Roosevelt remarked, "it is more intelligent to hope rather than to fear, to try rather than not to try." Of course, history stories of presidential leadership in hours of fear can be as often disappointing as they are heroic. The Civil War was the hinge of our national saga, and our brief survey will begin in earnest in the shadow of Appomattox. Southern anxiety was a critical factor in the coming of the Civil War. The fear that the peculiar institution of slavery could not survive, much less thrive, within the Union. And fear fundamentally shaped American life and politics in the Reconstruction period, well into the 20th century. The white fear of ceding too much power to free blacks, an anxiety that knew no regional boundary. The most profound issues of freedom and power, of domination and subordination, were in play. From decade to decade, the white fear of people of color and of immigrants played significant, sometimes decisive roles in the imaginations and the actions of the powerful. Writing in 1903, the scholar, historian, and activist W.E.B. Du Bois observed that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. And while he was surely right, It is correct, too, to say that color in some ways remains the problem of American history as a whole. Such talk is uncomfortable in the 21st century. After King, after Rosa Parks, after John Lewis, after the watershed legislative work of Lyndon B. Johnson in passing the civil rights bills of the mid-1960s, many Americans are less than eager to acknowledge that our national greatness was built on explicit and implicit apartheid. Yet for all that the United States has accomplished, and we have been a country that people take pains to come to, not to leave, we remain an imperfect union. Fear, as the political theorist Corey Robin has brilliantly argued, has been with us always. Understood by Robin and many scholars, both ancient and modern, as an anticipation of danger to oneself or to a group to which one belongs, including economic, racial, ethnic, religious, or other identity groups. It is among the oldest of human forces. Political fear arises from conflicts within and between societies, Robin wrote in his 2004 book, Fear, the History of a Political Idea, adding that political fear can be sparked by friction in the civic world and may dictate public policy, bring new groups to power and keep others out, create laws and overturn them. In the most elemental of terms, masters of such politics are adept at the manufacturing, or, if the fear already exists, the marshalling of it at the expense of those who one believes pose a threat to one's own security, happiness, prosperity, or sense of self. As Aristotle wrote in his Rhetoric, fear is caused by whatever we feel has great power of destroying us or of harming us in ways that tend to cause us great pain. Whatever we feel. Fear can be rational. Thomas Hobbes believed fear of the state of nature, a milieu without government and order, was the primary motivation for men to enter into society, forming mutual bonds of protection. But it is often irrational. To be concerned is not necessarily the same thing as being fearful. Fear is more emotional, more destabilizing, more maddening. Fear, Aristotle observed, does not strike those who are in the midst of great prosperity. Those who are frightened of losing what they have are the most vulnerable, and it is difficult to be clear-headed when you believe that you are teetering on a precipice. No passion, Edmund Burke wrote, so effectually robs the mind of all its powers of acting and reasoning as fear. The opposite of fear is hope, defined as the expectation of good fortune not only for ourselves, but for the group to which we belong. Fear feeds anxiety and produces anger. Hope, particularly in a political sense, breeds optimism and feelings of well-being. Fear is about limits. Hope is about growth. Fear casts its eyes warily, even shiftily, across the landscape. Hope looks forward, toward the horizon. Fear points at others, assigning blame. Hope points ahead, working for a common good. Fear pushes away. Hope pulls others closer. Fear divides. Hope unifies. The coward, then, is a despairing sort of person, for he fears everything, Aristotle wrote. The brave man, on the other hand, has the opposite disposition, for confidence is the mark of a hopeful disposition. In Christian terms, fear, according to St. Augustine, was caused by the loss of what we love. Building on Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas wrote that, properly speaking, hope regards only the good. In this respect, hope differs from fear, which regards evil. Augustine and Aquinas viewed the world in theological terms. In due historical course, the Puritans and successive generations of Americans would also see our national story in a religious context. To be sure, as Shakespeare wrote, the devil can cite scripture for his purpose, and the Bible has been used to justify human chattel, to cloak Native American removal with missionary language, and to repress the rights of women. At the same time, the great American reform movements have drawn strength from religious traditions and spiritual leaders. I do not know if all Americans have faith in their religion, for who can read the secrets of the heart? But I am sure that they think it necessary to the maintenance of republican institutions, Alexis de Tocqueville wrote in The Age of Jackson. That is not the view of one class or party among citizens, but of the whole nation. It is found in all ranks. There was a genius about the American founding and the emergence of American democratic politics. That genius lay in no small part in the recognition that the Republic was as susceptible to human passions as human beings themselves. The founders expected seasons of anger and frustration. They anticipated hours of unhappiness and unrest. Fear frequently defies constitutional and political mediation, for it is more emotional than rational. When the unreconstructed Southerner of the late 19th century or the anti-Semite of the 20th believed, or the nativist of the globalized world of the 21st believes, others to be less than human, then the protocols of politics and the checks and balances of the Madisonian system of governance face formidable tests. Mediating conflicting claims between groups, if one of the groups refuses to acknowledge the very humanity of the others, is a monumental task. Our Constitution and our politics, however, have endured and prevailed, vindicating the founders' vision of a country that would require amendment and adjustment. That the nation was constructed with an awareness of sin and the means to take account of societal changes has enabled us to rise above the furies of given moments and given ages. And while those furies sometimes ebb, they also sometimes flow. In a November 1963 lecture that formed the basis of a Harper's cover story and of a book, the Columbia historian Richard Hofstadter defined what he called the paranoid style in American politics, a recurring popular tendency to adhere to extreme conspiratorial theories about threats to the country. The paranoid spokesman sees the fate of conspiracy in apocalyptic terms. He traffics in the birth and death of whole worlds, whole political orders, whole systems of human values, Hofstadter wrote. He is always manning the barricades of civilization. He constantly lives at a turning point. It is now or never in organizing resistance to conspiracy. Time is forever running out. The measure of our political and cultural health cannot be whether we all agree on all things at all times. We don't, and we won't. Disagreement and debate, including ferocious disagreement and exhausting debate, are hallmarks of American politics. As Jefferson noted, divisions of opinion have defined free societies since the days of Greece and Rome. The art of politics lies in the manufacturing of a workable consensus for a given time, not unanimity. This is an art, not a science. There is no algorithm that can tell a president or a people what to do. Like life, history is contingent and conditional. In the American experience, at least so far, such contingencies and conditions have produced a better nation. Strom Thurmond's fate in the 1948 election is, in a way, itself an encouraging example. The Dixiecrat carried just four states, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Thurman's native South Carolina. Given a choice, a sufficient number of American voters believed Truman the right man to bet on. In electing the Democratic nominee to a full term, the people were picking a president who, in 1947, had addressed the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People at the Lincoln Memorial, a first for an American president, and who had commissioned a report to secure these rights, which offered a devastating critique of racial discrimination and detailed a civil rights program to bring African Americans into the mainstream. Truman's motivations were both strategic and moral. The black vote was important in urban areas outside the old Confederacy, and elections mattered. Principle and politics were intertwined. In Truman's view, candidates who carried the day at the polls would be able to do more in victory than they could in defeat. "It is my deep conviction," the president had told the NAACP, "that we have reached a turning point in the long history of our country's efforts to guarantee freedom and equality to all our citizens. It is more important today than ever before to ensure that all Americans enjoy these rights." He added, "When I say all Americans, I mean all Americans." The president had written the "all American" sentence in his own hand on a draft of the address. On the 4th of July, 1947, he had spoken to the NAACP just the week before. President Truman delivered a speech at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's mountaintop house. "In the wake of World War II," Truman said, "we have learned that nations are interdependent, and that recognition of our dependence upon one another is essential to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness of all mankind." Everything was linked. "So long as the basic rights of men are denied in any substantial portion of the earth, men everywhere must live in fear of their own rights and their own security," Truman said. "No country has yet reached the absolute in protecting human rights. In all countries, certainly including our own, there is much to be accomplished." History, Truman knew, is not a fairy tale. It is more often tragic than comic, full of broken hearts and broken promises, disappointed hopes and dreams delayed. But progress is possible. Hope is sustaining. Fear can be overcome. What follows is the story of how we have endured moments of madness and of injustice, giving the better angels of which Lincoln spoke on the eve of the Civil War a chance to prevail, and how we can again.
Chapter 1. The Confidence of the Whole People. Visions of the Presidency, the Ideas of Progress and Prosperity, and We the People. Energy in the executive is a leading character in the definition of good government. Alexander Hamilton, The New York Packet, Tuesday, March 18th, 1788. "I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon." Words popularly attributed to Sojourner Truth, the Woman's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio, 1851. Dreams of God and of gold, not necessarily in that order, made America possible. The first charter of Virginia, the 1606 document that authorized the founding of Jamestown, is 3,805 words long. 98 of them are about carrying religion to such people as yet live in darkness and miserable ignorance of the true knowledge and worship of God. The other 3,707 words in the charter concern the taking of all the lands, woods, soil, grounds, havens, ports, rivers, mines, minerals, marshes, waters, fishings, commodities, as well as orders to dig, mine, and search for all manner of mines of gold, silver, and copper. Explorers in the 16th and 17th centuries sought riches. Religious dissenters came seeking freedom of worship. In 1630, the Puritan John Winthrop, who crossed a stormy Atlantic aboard the Arbella, wrote a sermon, a model of Christian charity, that explicitly linked the New World to a religious vision of a New Jerusalem. "For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill," Winthrop said, drawing on Jesus's Sermon on the Mount. Forever shrewd about visuals, Ronald Reagan added the adjective shining to the image several centuries later. We've always lived with and perpetuated fundamental contradictions. In 1619, a Dutch man of war brought about 20 captive Africans, Negars, to Virginia, the first chapter in the saga of American slavery. European settlers, meanwhile, set about removing Native American populations, setting in motion a tragic chain of events that culminated in the Trail of Tears. And so, while whites built and dreamed, people of color were subjugated and exploited by a rising nation that prided itself on the expansion of liberty. Those twin tragedies shaped us then and ever after. As did basic facts of geography. There was a breathtaking amount of room to run in the New World. The vastness of the continent, the wondrous frontier, the staggering natural resources. These, combined with a formidable American work ethic, made the pursuit of wealth and happiness more than a full-time proposition. It was a consuming, all-enveloping one. For many, birth mattered less than it ever had before. Entitled aristocracies crumbled before natural ones. If you were a white man and willing to work, you stood a chance of transcending the circumstances of your father and his father's father, and of joining the great company of enterprising and self-made men, as Henry Clay put it in 1832. The next year, President Andrew Jackson appointed one such man to be postmaster of Salem, Illinois. Though a Whig at the time, Jackson was a Democrat, Abraham Lincoln was happy to accept. Lincoln's rise from frontier origins became both fable and staple in the American narrative. He understood the power of his story, for he knew that he embodied broad American hopes. "I happen, temporarily, to occupy this big White House," Lincoln told the 166th Ohio Regiment in the summer of 1864. "I am a living witness that any one of your children may look to come here as my father's child has." No understanding of American life and politics is possible without a sense of the mysterious dynamic between the presidency and the people at large. Sundry economic, geographic, and demographic forces, of course, shape the nation. Among these is an unspoken commerce involving the most ancient of institutions, a powerful chief, and the more modern of realities, a free, disputatious populace. In moments when public life feels unsatisfactory, then, it's instructive, even necessary, to remember first principles. What can the presidency be at its best? And how should the people understand their own political role and responsibilities in what Jefferson called the course of human events? In the beginning, at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, the presidency was a work in progress. Ambivalent about executive authority, many of the framers were nevertheless anxious to rescue the tottering American nation. Governed by the weak Articles of Confederation, national power was diffuse to non-existent. "The country," George Washington wrote in November 1786, was "fast verging to anarchy and confusion." The Constitutional Convention which ran from May to September of 1787, was focused on bringing stability to the unruly world of competing state governments and an ineffectual national Congress. In 1776's Common Sense, Thomas Paine had suggested the title of President for the leader of a future American government. Still, the colonial suspicion of monarchical power was evident in Paine's pamphlet. "But where, say some, is the King of America?" Paine wrote. "I'll tell you, friend, he reigns above, and doth not make havoc of mankind like the royal brute of Great Britain. For as in absolute governments the king is law, so in free countries the law ought to be king, and there ought to be no other." The tension between the widespread Paine view that central authority was dangerous and the practical experience of the Revolutionary War and the Confederation period, that a weak national government might be even more dangerous, shaped the thoughts and actions of the delegates who gathered in the Pennsylvania State House, now known as Independence Hall, in May 1787. Physically diminutive but intellectually powerful, James Madison, who laid out a plan for the new government with care, admitted the proper executive structure was a perplexing problem. "A national executive will also be necessary," Madison wrote fellow Virginian Edmund Randolph before the convention. "I have scarcely ventured to form my own opinion yet, either of the manner in which it ought to be constituted or the authorities with which it ought to be clothed." Madison's uncertainty reflected the reality of the time. There were competing schools of thought. On the floor of the convention, Alexander Hamilton of New York proposed a president to be elected for life. Others favored plans by which the legislative branch would select the executive, effectively creating a parliamentary system. Even when the drafting was done, the precise nature of the presidency, of its powers and relative role in guiding the nation, was an open mystery to the framers. Yet they were willing to live with ambiguity. Why? Because of George Washington. It was generally assumed that General Washington, a man with Cincinnatus-like standing who had voluntarily surrendered military power at the close of the Revolutionary War, would be the first to hold the presidential post. The delegates did provide that the president had to be a natural-born citizen, or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution, suggesting that there has always been a wariness of foreign influence and of the foreign-born. All in all, given the expectation of a President Washington, the creation of the office was an act of faith in the future and an educated wager on human character. From the start, Americans recognized the elasticity of the presidency and hoped for the best. Such hopes have not always been realized. Near the end of Donald Trump's first year in power, for instance, the New York Times reported that, before taking office, he had told top aides to think of each presidential day as an episode in a television show in which he vanquishes rivals. This Hobbesian view of the presidency, that every single day is a war of all against all, is novel and out of sync with much of the presidential past. In his 1867 book, The English Constitution, Walter Bagehot delineated the elements crucial to the government of a free people. First, those which excite and preserve the reverence of the population, the dignified parts, and next, the efficient parts, those by which it, in fact, works and rules. Bagehot argued that the projection of aspirations above the usual run of political business was vital. "The dignified parts of government," Bagehot wrote, "are those which bring it force, which attract its motive power." In the American context, this is especially true of the presidency. For the president